T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Good evening. Dr. Gerald Piper here on Medical Frontiers. And this evening, we're going to be talking about pediatrics. And we have as our guest, Dr. Brian Donnelly. Good evening, Dr. Donnelly. How are you this evening?
I'm well. How are you, Dr. Piper?
Doing great. There's a lot of buzz around the studio and in the medical community and the community at large about the announcement today by the FDA, okaying the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine for children ages 12 to 15. Could you just give us your take on that?
I think the buzz, the push would be to try to get schools open in the fall. And that would be a step to take that, to make the teachers and the adults feel better about that.
I know there's been a push in Pennsylvania, at least, to get the teachers vaccinated, and the next step would be to get the kids vaccinated. And is this vaccine going to be available for even younger children than 12 years of age, Dr. Donnelly? Is that the plan?
Yes, there are trials ongoing as low as Rajang is 6 months old.
Okay. So that'll be a big step to help get the schools open in the fall, which are children, you know, they absolutely need that. They need the socialization. They need to be face-to-face with their teachers and their classmates, and everyone will be happier once that occurs. Absolutely.
Right. I fully agree with that. We've seen a lot of kids with lots of mental health issues. So
I know as a pediatrician, you see children from birth until at least 18. And, a lot of adolescents, and we've talked before, that's really a kind of a tough age period to go through when a child reaches adolescence and going through puberty and so on. And then you throw in the isolation of not being able to go to school, having to take your classes online, Zoom conference, et cetera, et cetera. That has to take its toll on many, many children.
Right. I mean, like you said, adolescence is challenging under normal circumstances, so this makes it worse.
Yes, absolutely. And that just makes it worse when you have those natural things that are occurring to the body during that time, and then you have the pandemic thrown in there, and it just makes it worse. And we've talked to our psychiatrists, and there actually was a very good article in the in last week's Pittsburgh Business Times about the effect of the pandemic on behavioral health, and it really is amazing. And fortunately, we have the resources here in Pittsburgh to help handle that. But that can only go so far. If you have more demand than you have the supply, then there's a problem.
Right, you can overwhelm the system.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, that's enough about the vaccine for the 12 to 15. And I know that you have several areas of interest. And one of those is that you are a lactation expert. We've talked a bit about that on Medical Frontiers and previously, several years ago and so on. But why is that important? Why is it important for mothers, if at all possible, to breastfeed?
Well, it enhances the health not just for the baby but for the mom. There's some new information out about how it can protect mom against high blood pressure and diabetes and myocardial infarction as well as stroke.
Okay, and it also helps the mom with the contraction of the uterus after the birth of the child and everything getting back into normal sync as far as their hormones are concerned, their body is concerned. It is better for the mom when she breastfeeds for those things to occur.
Correct. Right.
Okay. And as far as the baby is concerned, it's really important because we can't manufacture something that is as good as the mother's milk for that particular baby. Isn't that correct?
Right. It's custom made.
Yeah.
And it's alive.
Right.
There are white blood cells and other factors that, right, you can never get in an infant formula.
And it helps the immune system of the baby from day one.
Right.
Yeah.
From the get-go.
Okay, what about, I understand that here in Pittsburgh, we even have a breast milk bank. Are you involved with that at all, Doctor?
Yes. Yeah, I'm on the advisory board, the Three Rivers Milk Bank.
Okay. And tell us how that works. Where do you get the breast milk?
It's donated by lactating moms around the area, and a large part of it, the vast majority of the milk, goes to NICUs in the area.
Okay.
Because the getting breast milk, whether it's donated, whether it's the same mom's milk or if it's donated mom's milk into the newborn, the premature baby, can be life-saving. It does a very good job of preventing necrotizing enterocolitis.
Okay, and it's and it doesn't matter that milk has come from a different mother, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, we need to take a break, and we're going to be talking about these things when we come out of the break. And if you want to ask Dr. Donnelly any questions about pediatrics, give us a call at 866-391-1020. That number again, 866-391-1020. We'll be back. We're back on Medical Frontiers, and tonight the subject is pediatrics, and we have as our guest physician, Dr. Brian Donnelly. So let's go right to the phone line. Linda in Manesson. Hello, Linda. Do you have a question of Dr. Donnelly?
Yes, sir. My daughter is going to have our first grandchild in June, like in about a month. So these days, or I don't know how long it's been going on, grandparents and parents are asked to get the DTaP vaccine. So I don't know that I'm going to be able to get it because of a pre-existing condition. And what danger does that pose to anybody, especially the infant? And when exactly does the infant receive that and is fully vaccinated?
Okay. How about that, Dr. Donnelly?
Right. The DTaP, the P in DTaP stands for pertussis, which is whooping cough.
Correct.
And the idea would be to protect anybody who's going to be around the baby from the whooping cough, because if babies get it, it's more serious than if an older person gets it. It could actually be life-threatening.
Correct.
The babies get that whooping cough vaccine starting at 2 months, and then 4 months, and 6 months. And then after a year, there's a booster, and then before kindergarten, there's another booster.
So would it be safe to be around them after 2 months, 4 months, or 6 months?
Right, the 2, 4, 6
if
months.
If I can't get the vaccine.
Right. So I guess if you would have to be extra cautious if you ever got a cold, because that would
okay.
be the main concern if you weren't protected against whooping cough. But 2, 4, and 6 months would be the series, and then after you complete the series, then you would be mostly protected, and then the boosters would just enhance that protection.
So basically 6 months. Okay.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your help.
Okay, Linda, thank you so much for the call, and glad that we could give you the answer about that very legitimate concern. Give us a call at 866-391 if you have questions of Dr. Donnelly, 866-391-1020. Dr. Donnelly, I also read somewhere that you do frenotomies for tight frenulums that cause tongue tie. How often is that found in a newborn where their tongue is sort of held a little too tight in their mouth?
The most studies that look at that in terms of occurrence in a population usually are in the 5 to 7% range.
Okay.
But there is controversy in terms of how much is significant. So there is a spectrum of severity, and the ones that are obvious, where the tongue cannot leave the floor of the mouth, so very restricted activity, those are easy to call, and those would be less common. And then there would be the less severe, the more maybe mild ones, and they tend to cause more trouble because it's confusing whether they're causing a problem or not.
Okay. Is there a problem in feeding with a tight tongue? Or how about later on as far as speaking is concerned?
Right. So if the tongue tie is severe, where the tongue, again, doesn't leave the floor of the mouth, then that could lead to speech problems later on.
Okay.
Usually saying L and TH, those sounds would be most impacted. And kids that have that severe tongue tie usually get speech therapy, and they might be somewhat difficult to understand if they don't get speech therapy. But most cases of tongue tie don't do that.
Okay. And what can be done to prevent that problem if it is diagnosed? I mean, how do you correct it?
Right. By just releasing the tissue, so either cutting it or I know lasers are used for that purpose.
I see. So there's a little bit of tissue, a little membrane at the bottom of underneath the tongue behind the lower lip. And so I can remember medical school where the obstetrician would check that, and if it, once the baby was delivered, they would check that. And if they felt it was done, they would just snip it a little bit. With a small pair of scissors and just snip that membrane so that it was no longer as taut. Is that what is done today also, if it is found? You could use a laser or something else, but can that be done right in the delivery room?
It can be. In fact, the doctor who taught me how to do it 9 years ago gave that story. She said that when she, was trained, if a baby came out, they would, if they noticed a tongue tie, they would fix it right there, cut the frenulum right there in the delivery room, and it went out of fashion, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
In fact, for a while, tongue ties, even more severe ones, were not being corrected.
Wow.
There was an opinion in medicine that there wasn't a need to fix it, that just leave it alone and the kid will be fine.
Okay, but if it happens in 5 to 7%, that's rather significant, and we know that there are children who get to school and they can't pronounce all the letters, and perhaps I had a tongue tied. I'm a good talker now. I think I talk a lot, but you say you have trouble with L's. I used to say, yet's pack a little yunch and have something to eat, Or my sister had a name of Linda, which starts with an L, and I would say, best her little heart yinda may. I said a Y instead of an L, so I probably had a tight frenulum. What do you think?
Well, it's radio, so I can't see.
Yeah, I think my tongue's okay now.
Okay.
Maybe I stretched it out enough that I could.
Oh, maybe, right, because some toddlers actually fix that accidentally.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right, that's right.
Okay. All right, and I was telling Rob that you probably see patients from, infancy to 18 years. Are there occasions where you see patients older than 18, if they've been patients of yours and they have some chronic diseases that you're very familiar with and taking care of them, that type of thing? Or is 18 a very, very strict cutoff?
We actually see children up to 21.
Oh, okay.
In this office, but yeah, over the years I've seen kids, as it were, young adults who didn't want to move on after 21. So we have to, it does happen, but some of them want to turn the page. So
I know sometimes with children with cerebral palsy, diabetes, and so on, sometimes it's hard to have somebody else take over, you know, once they reach the age of 18 or 21. And there are some pediatricians that just, you know, go ahead and continue to take care of those patients, which I think is very noble of them. You know, so.
Right, for continuity. Right, it's better for the patient, sure.
Absolutely. Okay, we only have about a minute before we take a pretty hard break. I want you to say a few words before that about the new hospital in Wexford and the pediatric services are going to be there.
Oh, well, I know last I heard they're on track to open in the fall.
Yes.
Of this year.
Yeah. And they're going to have full perinatal services, labor and delivery, and a NICU unit, and so on. So women who deliver there that have a premature baby or what have you, they can take care of the baby right there at that new hospital. We do need to take a break. This is Medical Frontiers, and you can get in touch with us by calling 866-391-1020. If you have a question, Dr. Donnelly, regarding pediatrics, we'll be back after the break. Okay, we're back on Medical Frontiers tonight talking about pediatrics with Dr. Brian Donnelly. And Linda, who had a question before the news, and she had another question. We had her hold through the news. Linda, do you have another question of Dr. Donnelly?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm going to be a new grandparent, so I'm just worried about certain things. And one is the immunization schedule. There are some parents nowadays that would like to space out their infant's immunization instead of, like, receiving two or three vaccines in one visit, like spread it out. Is that safe? And how do pediatricians feel about that when you ask them about it?
Dr. Donnelly, how about that?
Right. So at the, we mentioned the 2 month, 4 month, 6 month visits, there are two needles given and then one oral vaccine. In the past, so some years ago, it was four needles given. But now there's a combination, and that delivers more. So three of those components have been combined. So we talk to parents who want to space them, but often when they hear that it's just two, they're less worried about that. I think more of the worry came from four needles coming, you know, to the poor baby at one time. If you are concerned about that, the best thing to do would be to talk to the pediatrician at the time, because some offices have different policies about whether they would space it or not.
Okay, Linda?
Okay. Well, that's very helpful. Thank you again.
Okay, Linda. Thanks so much, and good luck being a grandmother. It is fantastic. We have six grandchildren, and we love it. You know, some people say that grandchildren are God's gift for not being too rough on your children when they were growing up. So it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Okay, let's go to Susie in Pittsburgh. Susie, do you have a question of Dr. Donnelly?
Yes, good evening. I have a goddaughter, and she's currently pregnant. And what she's concerned about is if she were to take which it should be Pfizer, Moderna, or the Johnson & Johnson one shot, and how does it affect pregnant mothers, because I've seen in the news recently that women have actually come through childbirth fine by getting the COVID vaccine for themselves. So any suggestions that you could give, because she's a first-time mom, and I have grown children, but she's a goddaughter that works and everything, and she just, you know, when you have that baby and it's significant, which babies are precious, all of them are a gift, I would want to give her the right information, and where should she call if she keeps having these concerns.
Okay, and we want to do what is best for that baby before,
right,
and mm-hmm, during and after birth. Dr. Donnelly, how about that?
Okay.
Right. The Pregnant moms were not included in the original trials, but
okay.
they've been watched in the meantime to see if there have been any troubles, and we've seen some come through the practice too, which they have seemed to have done fine. In terms of the which one to choose,
right,
it would be best for her to talk to her doctor.
Right. Well, that's what I've been explaining to her, because I've been following the science for her. And I'm very proud of her. Like I said, she works. And, I've been through childbirth 5 times, so it's no easy task. But with COVID, it's much more of a stressful situation for a first-time mom. So I will pass that information along. And what you were saying before, grandparents have to really dote on their grandchildren, but all children, I believe, are gifts from God. So I'll pass along the information. Thank you.
Okay.
And have a good evening.
Thank you very much for your question. Okay, let's go to October in Butler. Good evening, October.
Good evening. I have a question for you. When I was blind because of too much oxygen, and I had a friend of mine, I guess she was held or something for so long, and she had partial sight. Are they doing anything in the neonatal unit to prevent blindness, like cover their eyes or something, so premature babies do not end up blind like me?
Okay, excellent question. Dr. Donnelly.
Was there a name for your condition?
Well, they used to call it retinal fibroplasia, RLF. Now
yes.
They call it retinopathy or prematurity. It's the same thing.
Okay, yeah, those are two different things. The retrolental fibroplasia was thought to be from too much oxygen. And then now babies that are born, instead of getting 100% oxygen right away, the premature babies, it's monitored to see how much oxygen they need. So the oxygen delivery is tailored to what they need. And that problem, the complication, had been recognized, and that's what the neonatologists had done to prevent that. And I think, at least from my experience, that's been successful in there are many fewer cases, at least, that's called retrolental fibroplasia. Retinopathy of prematurity is harder to prevent because, as the name implies, the cause is prematurity. So it's a little bit more complicated, and there's different stages of that. But the more premature you are, the more likely you are to have that as a problem. But then the ophthalmologists have been following that for a while, and there have been more premature babies seeing the light of day over the past several years, so they've had a lot more experience dealing with that. But the retrolental fibroplasia is really more of a thing of the past.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay,
huh.
Okay.
Thank
October.
You.
Thank you very much for the question, and you have a good evening. Let's go to Sandy in Waynesburg. Good evening, Sandy. You have a question. Okay, we saw Sandy. All right. Dr. Donnelly, okay, how about... I wanted to ask you another question here. How about the very, very premature children? I know that in recent decades, children that are having, fewer months of gestation are still become a viable fetus, even when they're only a couple of pounds of weight and so on. What is your take on that, and how has technology and medical research and so on improved to the point where very, very premature children can still survive and become, good babies, good young children, and into adulthood?
Right. The technology, as it has advanced, more premature babies have been able to survive and then thrive afterward. But I remember when I went through training, 24 weeks seemed to be the outer limit. And I've been recently, a few months ago, I read 22 weeks is now the limit.
Okay. So 2 weeks of... less gestation and they're still surviving, which is really, really amazing. And that's why we have NICUs, newborn intensive care units.
Right, because that's all they do. And they, I think, are challenged by that. If it's a very young baby, then they can yeah. give it their best shot.
Okay. Well, we need to take another break. This is our last break before we take our break to say goodnight. This is Medical Frontiers, and we have Dr. Brian Donnelly as our guest. He's a pediatrician, lactation specialist. Give us a call at 866-391-1020 if you want to ask Dr. Donnelly a question in our last segment. We'll be back. Back on our last segment for Medical Frontiers, Dr. Pfeiffer here with Dr. Brian Donnelly, pediatrician. And Dr. Donnelly, I was racking my brain about the question that I wanted to ask you. During the break in the news, I finally remembered what it was about breastfeeding. And there are some women who want to breastfeed and they just can't. What are some of the reasons that a woman who has the desire to breastfeed but finds that she just can't do it?
That's lactation failure has been around for as long as lactation has been around, but now with other substitutes other than mom, most of those babies survive. Because back in the day, way before my time, your time, prehistoric days, right, if there was lactation failure, if there was no other mom that could help out, then, right, that baby wouldn't have made it. But, there's a percentage. It depends on what you read, what journals, but maybe 5 to 10% of moms can't at least produce enough for their baby without having to supplement. So there could be insufficient glandular tissue where the breast just didn't develop enough of the lactocytes, the cells that make milk. And there are other reasons. The ones that pediatricians tend to focus on would be the ones that we can do something about. So some of the more common reasons moms who start to breastfeed stop would be pain and the perception that they're not making enough milk. So most pediatricians focus on that. As long as the baby's getting enough, having enough wet and soiled diapers and gaining weight early on, then that would address the problem of the perception or the reality of not getting enough milk in. And the pain, there are other issues there. So you mentioned the tight tongue. And then if a frenulotomy is called for, then that can be done then. And the earlier you fix it, usually the better mom is in terms of pain and milk production too. But there are other causes of nipple pain. Some have to do with vasospasm. But most of the time it's just a latch.
Mm-hmm.
So the baby, breastfeeding is natural, but it's not necessarily automatic. And the mom and baby have to work out, learning a new skill. So the baby has to do some certain things and the mom has to adjust. And again, if the latch is painful, milk doesn't get delivered and mom doesn't feel like continuing.
Okay. 866-391-1020 is how you can have your questions asked. I have another question for Dr. Donnelly. When I was growing up, I heard my grandmothers talking about wet nurses. Could you tell us what a wet nurse is?
Right. Well, I kind of alluded to that. That would be a substitute for mom. It would be someone who would make the breast milk instead of mom.
But they would actually, instead of it going to a bank, the wet nurse would actually feed the baby from her breast.
Right.
Yep. And that worked pretty well. Maybe the baby did not survive that they had, or maybe they were ready to wean a baby of that they had, and they then could breastfeed another baby or two or whatever. Yeah.
Right. Sometimes the wet nurse was there if the mother was sick, if she couldn't breastfeed, or if the mom didn't make it through childbirth.
Okay, so it was just like having their own little breast milk bank.
Yes.
Back in the day before we even had refrigeration.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. Okay, Medical Frontiers, give us a call at 866-391-1020. Dr. Donnelly, I always like to ask our guests, what do you see out there in the future as far as pediatrics in general and the special areas that you're interested in the next 10, 15 years? What kind of things, what kind of advances do you picture out there?
To go to the start of the program, we're talking about COVID-19, that is certainly a challenge We have seen that kids in general, the younger you are, the less affected by it you are. And there had been some concern about kids spreading it around. So we should know more, a lot more about that particular virus in that 10 to 15 year period. The other thing, and that was what the you had talked about, the frenulotomy too. There was a mission statement that I was a part of. I was one of the co-authors on from the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine that laid out what the frenulotomy does. It relieves mom's pain and can help the breastfeeding process. I'm hoping that in 10, 15 years' time, there will be much more data, helpful data, to guide clinicians through the process. I mentioned the controversy. How do you know whether this particular mild tongue tie is causing problems or not? That's a question that pediatricians and family practice docs have when they see a baby in the office and mom is having pain. Hopefully we'll have more answers by then about tongue tie.
How about concussions in children?
Do you mean like treatment or?
Well,
prevention.
I used back in the day, a child would fall, they bump their head and so on, and not much was even thought about it. Get up, shake it off. So I think we've come a long way from that. Do you see anything out there in the future that may help with taking care of little kids with concussions?
Right. In terms of diagnosing the severity of it, that's an ongoing challenge, right? And I know just what you mean. Yeah, I know when I had been back in the day on a football team, I know I had a concussion, and it wasn't called that.
Right.
Yeah.
You got your bell wrong.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But we've come a long way, and I know that AHN has developed a program to help children who have had a concussion and so on. So. Those things have already been in the pipeline there for the last decade or so, which is really good. Okay, we can't take any more calls. Dr. Donnelly, I really appreciate you being with us this evening. And one of these days, maybe we can see each other face-to-face instead of by phone.
Right.
So, okay, thanks so much. We appreciate it. This is Medical Frontiers saying good night. Good health to everyone, and hope everyone had a nice Mother's Day yesterday in spite of the weather. We'll be back in 1 week.